been so long. I open up to you just like a best friend, but I don't want no scars, so I'm running.
So I'm running
in a hurry,
in a hurry,
trying not to get caught up. It's nonsense for me. Told my mama,
not to worry,
but I'm falling again. Yes, I'm falling again. Think of things to rest from my heart. It's when I love.
Airing on Asheville FM, 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is The Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. This week, we're featuring a conversation with Mohammed Horaini, a young activist from Masafariata, an area in the hills south of Hebron in the occupied West Bank of Palestine. Mohammed is a member of a nonviolent group called Youth of Samud that struggles to hold on to the lives and sites of Palestinian villages despite displacement by the Israeli military occupation, as well as the illegal Zionist settlements such as the neighboring Havat Ma'on, and their routine violence and impunity. For the hour, Mohammed speaks about his work with Youth of Samud, their recent report co-published with The Good Shepherd on increased settler violence entitled Indigenous Erasure, How the Zionist Movement is Using State-Sanctioned Violence to Eliminate the Palestinian Communities of the West Bank. We also talk about South African genocide case against Israel in the International Court of Justice and other topics. You can learn more about Youth of Samud at youthofsumud.org. And pretty soon there will be a transcript of this conversation as well for easier reading. If that's your style, you can find it alongside many, many others, including printable zines of our episodes at tfsr.wtf/zines, Z-I-N-E-S. If you're in the Asheville area, next Sunday, February 4th, there are a few events that I'd like to share about. From 11 a.m. until 8 p.m. at Different World on Haywood Road in West Asheville, there will be a showing of films about Palestine, as well as, I'm sure, discussions and other such things related to it. Also, between 2 and 4 p.m. at AB Tech in the Asheville campus, there will be a panel of Palestinian journalists at the Ferguson Auditorium. Also, from 3 to 5 p.m., Blue Ridge ABC will be having its monthly political prisoner letter writing event at Firestorm Books. So, hope to see you at some of these. For any listeners that are in the SF Bay Area, KPFA 94.1 FM out of Berkeley, which airs The Final Straw Wednesdays from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. each week, is conducting a survey to gauge which shows KPFA listeners tune in for. If you like being able to tune in and listen to the show on KPFA, and the fact that these conversations can be heard by everyone in range of their transmitter, which is a pretty huge area, we would encourage you to share your thoughts at www.kpfa.org/listener-survey. The survey is open until the end of the day, Wednesday, January 31st. Thanks. Another couple of quick announcements. Also, the 75th episode of Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World by the A Radio Network is out for January 2024. It includes a segment from Chernoluknia talking about detained anti-fascists in Budapest and the Solidarity Campaign for Their Freedom. They were in Budapest. These two German activists were in Budapest who were opposing a very large fascist gathering on the 11th of February in 2023. The Hungarian police arrested folks during the demonstration, and 14 international arrest warrants came afterwards, and it's all sorts of mess. Anyway, you can learn more about the Solidarity for the Anti-Fascists from Budapest in that episode, as well as an interview from Frequenza from Germany with Anya of Solidarity Zone about Ruslan Siddiqui, an anarchist accused and imprisoned in Russia of sabotage against the Russian war in Ukraine, as well as a short segment of our interview with Yuval Dag, an Israeli anarchist who has been incarcerated for refusing military service during this war on the people of Gaza, and finally also a segment from A-Radio Berlin, which includes some background with an autonomous activist from the 80s and 90s about the clandestine magazine Radikal. So that and past episodes can be found at a-radio-network.org. Also, if you're interested, we're releasing a couple of episodes early on Patreon for folks that are donating for $3 or more every month. They can get earlier access to things like our conversation from last week with two supporters of anti-fascist prisoner Alex Stokes, who has been convicted of basically community defense and self-defense at January 6th, 2021 rally in Albany, New York, where a bunch of Proud Boys started jumping people. Alex is serving 20 years in prison. He and his supporters have appealed the conviction, and their arguments are going to be heard, hopefully, by a higher court that might allow them to challenge the conviction or at least the sentence of his case. You can find more about that at freealexstokes.org. And we're going to be releasing an interview pretty soon that Ian did with folks from Project Mayday, a peer-led harm reduction project out of West Virginia. So we got some good stuff coming up, and if you want to support our transcription effort, we've got a bunch of transcripts that just came out. Great material to send into incarcerated comrades, or great for folks that prefer to read over hearing interviews. So yeah, check it out. And if you feel like supporting us, you can find more at tfsr.wtf/support, or join our Patreon at patreon.com/tfsr.
My name is Mohamed Hreni from Masafriyatta, a human rights defender in Youth of Sumud Group. Masafriyatta is in the south and west bank, lays on the green line bordering the 48 occupied land.
Would you tell us a bit about Youth of Sumud, how the group started, where it works, and what it does?
Yeah, Youth of Sumud is a youth grassroots which born during an experience in 2017. In a village that was evicted in Masafriyatta in 1999 by the Israeli occupation forces. This village was one of the eight villages that was evicted in that time by the Israeli forces. So since that time until 2017, there was no one living there after that eviction in 1999. So, one of the reasons of the eviction is to expand the settlements and build more settlements on the Palestinian grounds and stealing more lands and deny the Palestinians from their basic rights to work in their lands. I mean, the ideology of the occupation is to occupy and displace the Palestinians, ethnically cleanse the land from the Palestinians. So here was like when I started my activism is with this group, which my bigger brother Sami, he was like the coordinator of this group. So the idea is to create the life in this village and to encourage the people to back to their homes after this evacuation, and to recreate the life and to encourage the people to back to their homes. Even this village is just about, like, it just mostly of, like, the people used to live in the past in the caves. So, you know, the first step we just start is to work in the caves, to destroy it, to make it able to live for the people, build some bathrooms, even planting their lands with trees, to make it like it as it was before. You know, this experience took like a lot of time with us. We left our families in from everyone of the group. He left his family and he just go in this village. You know, we used to sleep there and being presence there in 24 hours presence. So it was a hard choice for us, and everyone paid a high price for that, because at the beginning of that experience, we have like many pressure and attacks by the Israeli settlers and the army. So in order, you know, it was like a strong message from the occupation is that they don't want anyone to be in this village. You know, the night raids and destroying the properties that we used to plant it, and arresting us in the night and terrorizing us is one example. I mean, during that experience, I was like about 13 years old, and it was like, I mean, really, really afraid. Like, I was really afraid of facing this, but by the time and by my experience, I got used to that. But I shouldn't get used to that because this is not normal for a human, you know? So, like, our group start to extend and being, like, a human rights defenders for all our people in all of the West Bank, you know, defending them. And, you know, accompanying our activities was to accommodate the shepherd who used to be attacked by the Israeli settlers. And, you know, doing campaigns like Faza campaign, who helped the Palestinian farmers in the olive season harvest, is to go all over West Bank helping the Palestinians everywhere who faced the attacks by the settlers and stealing their olive trees and burning it and breaking it. And we are as a group, you know, we are believing in the nonviolent resistance means. I born in a family that believes in this way. And also doing like other campaigns like Defund Racism, which is like focuses on the Israeli Zionist organization that shows the world that is a charity organization on the ground. And in fact, this is an organization that committed the war crimes against our people and being a part of ethnic cleansing the people here. For example, Ragavim organization, which is like an organization that follows the Palestinians who build a home in his land. And, you know, bringing the army for them and giving them demission orders. So this is like a part of being a part of like displacing the people and little more people being refugees and homeless. And this organization was supported by the U.S. government, even with millions of dollars and other organizations, I mean. So, like, I mean, our group faced many, like, challenges during its experience by the attacks and even the arrests. I mean, many assaults and threatening in the night to when they raid your house and threatening your father and your family, you know, in order to stop our activism and stop our movement, you know, to defend our rights. Like, even if you want to ask me why, because I just want to give you an idea about Musafir Yatta, which is, like, it includes around 33 villages, most of like half of it or like the quarter of it, like it was evicted during the 1999 by the Israeli occupation forces. So Musafir Yatta started to suffer from the occupation in the early 80s when the Israel Supreme Court declared Musafir Yatta as a firing zone military training for the army. So this was the first excuse and the dangerous one to evacuate the Palestinians from their homes. I mean, to speak about my family level, my grandparents, they were refugees in the 1948, and two brothers of my grandfather were killed in that massacre. So my grandparents flee from there and come to Musafir Yatta, which was their last piece of land here in 20 village around the 60s or the 50s in the last century. And, you know, my father and all of my uncles and my aunts were born here. So when they declared as a firing zone area, the military base started to build on the Palestinian lands and then building homes and settle the Israeli settlers in. It was a war crime that was happening. So the settlers are a tool of the Israeli occupation in order to terrorize the people and attacking them and stealing more lands, you know. This was how it was going since the 80s and declaration of Musafir Yatta as a firing zone area of the military training of the army. So then here, like, it was the oppression, the aggression, and the terrorizing the people, how it was started. To speak about after the war crime that happens in 1999, the evacuation of eight villages in Musafir Yatta, the people in Musafir Yatta and my father and other actors, the Israel Supreme Court, and giving all of the proofs of the ownership of the land, and at least to do something against all of the crime that happens against the people. At the end, in 2000, the Israel Supreme Court gave an interim injunction allowing the villagers to back to their homes and land, but banning them from any new essential infrastructure. So this is like was giving an interim injunction. Most of the people, they were not able to come back because they were afraid to be evicted another time. As one example, Sarura village that my group born there. And, you know, it continues the actions and events until 2006 when the Israeli government were going to build the apartheid wall around Musafir Yatta and to include it to the 48 lands, occupied lands. And this case caused to a weekly demonstration against the apartheid wall from all of Musafir Yatta people against the wall. And everyone paid a high price for that. Everyone, like most of the people here, at least spent 6 months, 4 months in the jail for calling to remove the apartheid wall. But at the end, they succeeded to remove it. And in this period of time, you know, we as a new generation, like me and other guys, born under this rule of the occupation.
seeing our families, how they are resisting by the nonviolent means and learning how to face this occupation, as we are a people who are having no power even to face the occupation. And, you know, we're just born under this injustice reality and trying to look for a ways to fight the occupation and end the occupation of, and end the crimes and the violation of the basic human rights.
So obviously, and it's clear through what you just said, the current group, the Youth of Samud, comes from this long heritage of resistance in various forms, engaged by people that generationally have been on this land. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of the name? Like, what does Samud translate to? And
Samud means the steadfastness. So it means the resilience of the youth and of the people also. Like, this is like, what's the meaning of the name of the group? Like,
so I wonder if you could talk specifically about Sarura and a little bit more about that specific community and the work that your group has done there.
Yeah, Sarura, as I said before, like, it's one of the villages that was evicted. So our idea was to create the life and to break the plans of the occupation by stealing the plans of this village and extend the settlements there. Our presence there were even to break these plans and even bring international attention and international visitors there, and, you know, to bring awareness about the situation and all the entire area of Massa Ferjatta. So, like, Sarura is one of the villages, like, that was the plan on it to occupy it quickly and in short term. And other villages like Touba and other villages that faces even the settler attacks and demolition houses by the Israeli government and all of the, you know, banning the even the water net to go to these communities and even the electricity, you know, this like was a part of denying the people from their basic human rights. And this was even against all of the laws in this world, you know, and this, you know, shows the reality of the occupation that is really trying to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians and commit war crimes against them. And here, even as like the new generation decided to face the occupation and to stand for his rights. I mean, our group, when it started to go with the people to help them to face, even we're from the same community, but the people even proud of that there is a group from their community that came up to stand and being a real body on the ground to face and to present their community, you know? Like, I don't know if I forget something to speak about the violations and daily violations of the what we are facing. I said about the demolition houses, you know, like, I mean, weekly there's a demolition order and demolition of houses for the Palestinian in Massa Ferjatta. But when you want to compare it with the settlements, that settlements even are in the firing zone area where they declared it as a firing zone, military training for the army, that there is all of the human services that are for the settlers who's living there, and they are living illegally there. And you are the indigenous people on your land. You are denied from even having the water. Even they are banned from the right to movement to go to your land. So this kind of, you know, making you crazy and lose your mind, like, how is this going on? And the world outside are believing that Israel is a democratic state. Well, I mean, where is the democracy that I didn't never see and it never existed on the ground? This is like the Israeli propaganda, how it's, you know, it shows that it's really strong and can, you know, can change the reality quickly. So this is like what we are working to broke lies and injustice and to broke everything that is occupation built on our account.
Obviously, if settlements are coming in and you say that they have all of the necessary infrastructure that they could want, when you say that the injunction allowed for Palestinian folks to move back to the land, but there was a ruling against building necessary infrastructure. Is that right? Can you talk about what that infrastructure is? You're mentioning water. So I'm imagining water catchment, electricity.
They banned you from the electricity. They banned you from the water. They banned you even to build a house for you. So most of the people right now in Massa Ferjatta are living in tents and caravans, which is even under the threat to being confiscated and demolished. And most of the people now, they are just depends on the caves and living in the caves. So you have no rights to build your own house, your like respectful house to stay you and your family to sleep in. I mean, this when this interim injunction was like posed, forget to tell you this part, that in 2022, the Israel Supreme Court gives the final decision, which gives the green line for the Israeli army to do anything in Massa Ferjatta, which is we have started witnessing by destroying and demolishing a lot of homes in the, of Palestine in Masafer Yatta, you know. And even after the 7th of October, I mean, it became more crazy that the settlers who have no legal way to have guns and to have to wear military uniforms and even to have bulldozers and demolishing Palestinian homes and burning it and terrorizing the people. So this, like, this case is becoming more and more crazy. And, you know, if you're on the ground and everyone, I hope most of the listeners who's listening to us now to come and to see the reality on the ground and not just follow the news on of the Israeli propaganda, just came and see the reality and the fact on the ground and see how the Palestinians are really facing the apartheid regime and the racist policy of the occupation. Yeah, I want to just say that in my house now, and there's a settlement far away from here, just 300 meters from my home, and just they have all of the human services. And my village, the main village that have now and human services, this is after 2010 that we got it, after a long fight with the occupation and long pushing of the even the school, the clinic, the kindergarten. This we got it after really a history of fighting with the occupation to got it after even the intervene of Tony Blair, who was the British minister. So after this intervene, he just like we just got the master plan that we are allowed to build. We are the main village that we can build, but other village that's far away from here, half a kilometers from here, they have nothing. They are just sleeping in caves, in caravans. They have the water. They got it. They got from the wells. They collect the rainwater and then they just use it. And sometimes the settlers poison these wells of water and denied the people from having water. So the people used to go and to risk with their tractors to bring water with their tanks. And sometimes they got confiscated by the Israeli army and police. So we are. Even like me, we are and the settler under the same control, but there is an apartheid regime that's, you know, acting against the occupation, but against the Palestinians.
Are these courts at all, like, are the Israeli courts that are offering these injunctions or issuing them, how do they deal with the, as you say, the illegality of Israeli settlers building into areas where you have been evicted from that you say are firing zones? If they're illegal, are the legal systems of this so-called democracy in Israel challenging those settlements?
Okay, to speak about the law and the legality, let's speak about the international law. First, the settlements are illegal according to international law, and the outpost, even that's the beginning, that we call it outpost, is the beginning of the settlement, of establishing a settlement. It's even illegal in the Israeli law, but look how much they are like hypocrite by their law. Like they are even against their law that they put it, is just to show the world that they have a law. They are building outposts and settlement, and when you want to go to the court, and we as a Palestinian in Area C, according to Oslo Agreement, we're under the military control, occupation control. So we are going to military courts, you know, Palestinian, but the settler who's upstairs, who's living in the settlement, he just used a civilian law against him. So, you know, how much that they are like bearing between the Palestinian and the settler who's living in the outpost. And when you go to the judge, where is this judge from? He's like a judge from one of the settlements. So he's a settler. He's living in one of the settlements and he's trying to evacuate the Palestinians from their homes and terrorizing them. So you are going to the judge. He's your executioner, you know, that he will never give the justice for you.
And I know that this has been documented for a very long time, but can you talk a little bit about the international law that the settlements are contravening? The international law that they're breaking, basically, by allowing for settlements.
Okay. Yeah, that's the settlement like illegal under the international law, but they can also amount to the international crimes. So, like to the Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention states that the occupying power shall not deport or transfer parts of its own civilian population into the territory it occupies. Also prohibits the individual or mass forcible transfers, as well as, you know, deportations of the protected persons from occupied territory, you know, and also the settlements that are created by both those practices. Israel displaces us from our land, and to put why is to put, you know, colonial settlers in. So, like, the key acts required for the establishment of the settlements amount to the war crimes under the Rome Statute of International Criminal Court. Under this body of law, that the extensive destruction and like appropriation of the property not justified by military necessity and carried out unlawfully and unwantedly. Like, to speak about the legality of the settlements, it's really prohibited even and illegal according to international law. But, like, I mean, why there until now there is no any international intervene in this, you know, in situation, and the occupation is continuing since the 48 since the Nakba, you know. Then, you know, I mean, the Nakba didn't stop in that time because it's still ongoing, you know, like against the Palestinians, because Israel didn't stop to commit war crimes every day. Like, it continues to kill and to steal more lands and to build settlements and, you know, to put the settler militias to arise and, you know, committing war crimes and genocide against the Palestinians.
Yeah, and it looked like, from my understanding of it, in the prior years, when there were international challenges brought through the legal system, through the United Nations, for instance, or adjacent courts, they were always blocked by the United States, by Israel, and by the UK, by other, like, allied countries that had a specific geopolitical view of what they wanted, I guess, the region to look like and the role of Israel as a military outpost to be. But people have been talking recently more and more about the violence that has occurred since October 7th and into today between what Hamas did and what the Israeli occupying forces have done in Gaza and in the West Bank, as if it were without this context of decades and decades of violence that you're talking about right now. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about, like, what was happening before the 7th of October and before Palestine comes into the news and into the awareness of people around the world, not for everyone, obviously, but for a lot of people around the world, in these huge blips of violence where the Israelis decide to lay siege to Gaza and to, like, bring in warplanes and drop bombs or impose a blockade that denies medical goods and food and all these other things. But there's these intervening years, as you say, of day-to-day violence and settler colonial expansion that doesn't get talked about. Can you talk a little bit about how it feels to be someone who has been experiencing this all of your life and just to hear your people and your country being talked about when bombs are dropping?
Yeah, I mean, just I want to also say, like, as you said, that, you know, everything didn't start after, like, since the 7th of October, you know, as I said, and you said, like, it started since the Nakba, since the 48. So, I mean, as we as a Palestinian, we have been calling for decades for our, like, justice and for our rights and for our freedom against, like, and to get rid out of the occupation. And, I mean, living under the same policies and the same crimes that it commits against us before the 7th of October. So I just want to say that after the 7th of October, it just got worse because the Israeli settlers are taking advantage of the war because there is no attention as it was before, because all of the attention is on the Gaza. So the settlers are taking advantage that they're committing war crimes. During that period, in the 13th of October, my cousin was shot by a settler. He just get in my village and shot him from zero distance and wounding him in the stomach. And the bullet that he was shot by, which is the prohibited bullet according to international law, is the expanding bullet, which is affected most of his parts in his stomach, which is like caused to for him to stay around 85 days in the ICU.
Damn.
And just before 2 weeks get out of the hospital. So imagine, like, how much the situation got crazy after the 7th of October, because the settler are, you know, taking advantage. And until now, the settler who shot my cousin, he's not in jail, you know, and he's free until now, because there is no justice to bring for us. You know, there is no power for us as Palestinians. There is no rights. They didn't deal with the Palestinians as a human. They're just dealing with us as a number, just like who's, like, on the ground walking.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm glad to hear that he's out of the hospital at least. That's such a long time, and I'm sure there's some lasting damage from using that dum-dum bullet. So your organization, Yusuf Samud, collaborated with a group called Good Shepherd Collective to publish a booklet in November of 2023 that was called Indigenous Erasure, How the Zionist Movement is Using State-Sanctioned Violence to Eliminate the Palestinian Communities of the West Bank. In it, you documented how the, quote, Israeli war on Hamas, unquote, as the U.S. media promotes it, as if the war that's going on in Gaza is just affecting Hamas, but how it's grabbing headlines, and Zionist settlers have in the meantime displaced at least 16 Palestinian communities in the West Bank, like you're talking about right now. They're using the cover of the tragedies that occurred against non-combatants on the 7th, and then also the attention, the international attention on the war in Gaza, to further steal land. Can you talk about this report and how it's been received by people that have read it?
Yeah, but first of all, I would just like to seize this opportunity to talk about the international media piece in using the term Israeli war on Hamas, as if the murder of over 20,000 Palestinians and displacement of millions in Gaza has any relationship with eliminating Hamas. And, you know, what's happening now is, like, I want to just say it again, is a merely continuity of our ethnic cleansing since, like, started in 1948. And I mean, about the booklet, you know, we just, like, it will be, you know, clearly how, like, the Israeli settlers and the occupation forces displaced and was caused the displacement of the people and leaving them being a refugee. And again, you can see the attacks and the full stories of the people there, and to check how everything, to understand the situation in the West Bank, so how the policies are used against the Palestinians. I mean, when, like, I hope also the listeners, they can just go and see this booklet, and so they can understand more and more, because it's like a long booklet that we do with the Gochebert Collective. So, I mean, it's also like it includes what I said before during the interview.
Yeah, it's a very straightforward read with lots of documentation. It's very useful. And you're actually quoted in the Indigenous Erasure Report having been targeted by multiple attacks by Zionists from the Havmaon settlement. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some of these experiences that are talked about in the journal.
Yeah, well, since I started my activism at age 13 and being a human rights defender and defending our rights, I was just like a young and having, you know, like a lot of power to move and go around. And so encouragement from my father and my parents. So I used to go even firstly, like I want to tell you about my daily activity is to accompany the school children who came from Tuba village to come to educate to my village. Because my village have the main secondary school in Masafar Yatta. So the village is around and the students used to come to my village. So the settlements are built in mid between the two villages. It will make a hard move between the two villages. So the children who need to come to educate, they get attacked many times by the Israeli settlers and even the army. And this, you know, and this, like, what's the violation of the education in Masafar Yatta, like you can say. So I used to accompany school children while even I was a child, and I need a protection from that to take the, and like to come to wait them until, you know, because I want to just tell you from the beginning of this school children story. These children, you know, my village and this village, between them, they're just 1.5 kilometers, the distance. So in the middle of it, the settlement of Mahon built on the road that connected these two villages. So anyone who used, after the establishment of this settlement, anyone used the road, he would have been attacked many times. And maybe he would risk his life. So in 2004, there was two American international used to work with these children to accompany them in the middle of the settlement. And they were from the CBT organization. It's an American organization. They used to accommodate the children in the morning. And the settler, you know, at some point, they attacked them and attacked them brutally. And one of the international was really attacked hardly and brutally. He was hospitalized. He was bleeding. So what helped this children case is one of the Americans was attacked and attacked brutally. His mother was in the American Congress, which did pressure on the Israeli government to do a solution for these children. So this is what the main thing. So without the international presence in Masafar Yatta or in the West Bank, there will be no solution for the Palestinians. So after that, what the Israeli government did is to use a military jeep to accompany these children to come to the school, rather than to take off the settlements that's built illegally on the Palestinian lands. So this jeep came in the morning and the afternoon to bring the children to school and take them back safely to their homes. But even though the Israeli soldiers who need to accommodate the Palestinian children, sometimes they didn't show up to do their job. Sometimes they got late on the children. So this was with the intent to win aid and to not bring these children to school. So this was even my activity since the 2017, is to bring these children and waiting them. If there is no army to bring these children, I used to take by my own to go to bring these children. I just open the camera and document everything what happens with us. And during this activism, I got arrested around 5 times because I'm with just accommodate the children, with doing something humanity with the children. So because the settler used to tell the army, because also one thing that you should know about Musafir Yatta, here on the ground, the army are just a servant for the settler, for the settler who's living in the outpost and the settlement. Anything that they told the soldier, they are the believed people. So they said to go to take me out of the place that I am there, they will go. So here what was like I was facing is the army came and telling me to go out from the place that I used to wait the children. And I refused because there is no any legal thing that they can show me to take me up out of there. And at the end, they just arrest me and stayed for a few days and then pay a fine and come back to continue my activism. To arrest me and to put me in jail, this way is to terrorize me and stop me from doing this, what I was doing. But I continued until I finished my high school after like 5 years of accompanying the children, being with them. So this is like one of the stories that I have. I just want to share it with you about this attacks on me. They used to come while I'm in my land to kick me out of there. Once I was, me and my father attacked by the Israeli settlers. And after they attacked us, they accused my father that he was trying to murder a settler in the middle of the settlement. Imagine that. So my father was arrested for 10 days, at least for detention until the judge just said anything. So during this period, we got an international activist who was documenting the accident that happened, the attack that was happened by the settlers. So this is what helped my father case to get out of the jail. Otherwise, he will be in jail for at least 10 years for this lies charges. And even that, when my father was innocent from these charges, they let him pay 10,000 shekel as a fine to get out from the jail, and also put in him sanction that he will be banned from reaching the land for 1 month. So imagine how we are just facing the injustice from the occupation and how they are just putting pressure on us to leave from our land.
Yeah, that's incredible. Because you mentioned before, it would be good for people from the listening audience to come and witness the apartheid that exists where you're at and the importance of having people there as witnesses. Can you name a couple of the organizations that either that person who was documenting, who helped your father's case, was from, or the group that was helping to accompany the children, any of the organizations that you respect that are active showing up in person in Musafir Yatta?
Yeah, I respect all of the movements who just came and the organization who just came to stand in solidarity with the people. There is like many organizations. There is like Operation Dove organization from Italy that have been in Musafir Yatta since 2004. And there is the ISM organization, which is the International Solidarity Movement from the UK, I think. They are like also in Musafir Yatta trying to presence with the people to be everywhere to document all the violation in Musafir Yatta. There was CBT, the Community Peacemaker Team, is an American organization that used to come here in Musafir Yatta since a long time. And also, I forget some of the other organization, but there is like who's the mainly who's always present in Musafir Yatta, this like the main organizations. And also there is like an Israeli activist who's against the occupation and against the violation of the Israeli occupation, who's also used to being present in Musafir Yatta and sleeping with the people. And who's even these people are getting attacked more than the Palestinians because they are with the Palestinian side.
Yeah, they're sort of being considered traitors to the settler cause, I guess. Yeah, thank you. And I can put links to those and, of course, to this report in the show notes so that listeners can find more information about them and read the report themselves, as you say. Since October 7th, there has been media narratives in the U.S. and in the West and on Wikipedia and elsewhere that has been claiming that the increased violence, all of the military assaults that are occurring by the Israeli forces are in response to a specific group that they're calling Hamas. I think that in Israeli society, as I understand and what I've seen through media representations, there's a statement that all these people are this thing is our enemy. All like, though I've heard people say, like, we need to stop the terrorists as a way of justifying the bulldozing of whole neighborhoods and displacement of people into areas that they're calling a safe zone, and then the military bombing that safe zone. Can you talk about the narrative in the media and what it, the damage that it does, saying that this is Israel's war on Hamas rather than on Gaza or on the Palestinian people?
When you want to, like, as I said, it's like all just came back to the Israeli propaganda and Israeli, like, it's like unprovoked narratives that they are talking about. So, like, they are justifying for themselves to commit more war crimes against the Palestinians by, you know, saying that this is like Hamas headquarters, and for example, like headquarters, like, lay under the hospitals, and they just bombed the hospitals and, you know, affect many people who got killed, and many martyrs, hundreds of martyrs got killed. And, you know, just, you know, they're giving justifiers with no any proofs that they can give. And until now, we didn't have any, you know, proofs that can say that there's a Hamas headquarters that lies under this hospitals, or like killing the, demolishing the house of the Palestinian. I mean, what's the main reason of demolishing a house and making Palestinian, an innocent Palestinian, making him and a homeless? I mean, so what they just can justify all of this thing that's happening? What, like, how would you justify the kill, like the shooting of my cousin in 20? Like, I just want to say, what's the justification of that? Like, I mean, to be honest, like, what I used to hear about, like, something like stories like that, what they have seen, that he just, like, tried to do an operation and just try to kill a settler. But in fact, the settler is in the middle of the village. So who's come to commit a crime in the middle of the village is the settler who was armed, you know. So mostly, like, they are just, like, giving justification of what they are doing, you know. And the problem is the word that is, like, supporting them. And, you know, just, like, pushing on in their hands to continue their, like, genocide and war crimes against the Palestinians.
Yeah, and then afterwards saying maybe, oh, well, I'm sorry that some people got hurt in the meantime. This is not our intention. They shouldn't have been there or whatever.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I mean, they said, like, I don't know, like, I mean, their excuses and their justification is really, really silly and irony, you know? Like, you're just, like, killing humans. We're losing every day souls and humans, and we're losing not the numbers, you know. There are humans, man. Like, I mean, this word that since I just born until now, I just was hearing for the justice and for peace. Which peace you are talking about? And you're just supporting the apartheid regime and supporting the occupation, you know?
So you've talked about the Youth of Samud as a nonviolent organization, which means it has to rely on civil disobedience, on outside observers, appeals to morality and appeals to law to do what you do. Can you talk about what the grounding of that choice of nonviolence is? Is it a pragmatic safety approach? Is it philosophical, maybe a mixture of the two, and how effective you found it to be interacting in that way?
Yeah. So let me add this thing that, you know, we as a Palestinian under the occupation and according to the international law, we have the right to resist in any way, by the violent or the nonviolent way. So we as a people, as like, we just like believed in the nonviolent way also, even to at least protect yourself. Even you are using the nonviolent means, that means you are not under the risk of being killed by the Israeli apartheid regime. Because we have witnessed many friends who got killed, even they are just fighting by the nonviolent means. And there is even a friend of my father, he was like in administrative detention for years, you know, in the jail with no charges until now. And he's like with the nonviolent means. So, I mean, using any kind of means like of resistance against the occupation, you are under to pay, you know, the price to being an activist. So I born in a family that have a long experience with the occupation, you know, they have suffered a lot and being displaced 2 times from their homes. So my grandmother, she's the main one who just teach us how to face this occupation and even at least to protect yourself from not being shot. But even we just discover that being able to be killed in any moment without no reason. So we choose it, as you know, with the people who believed at least to fight and to stay in your land. Otherwise, you know, in the ground, if you use any form of the violent resistance, you will be just more than, and you will cause the effect on the other people, you know, because Israel is using even the collective punishment against the Palestinians. I mean, this was choice, you know, even by like all of my community who choose this way to resist the occupation. And like the effectively of it, you know, the main thing that we succeeded in is to remove the apartheid wall in 2006. And this was like a very and a strong successor for us. But until today, the occupation is still planning for building, rebuilding this apartheid wall again.
And we are hoping that the international community at some point will intervene and stop all this genocide and the war crimes that's committing against us as a Palestinian in the West Bank and also in Gaza.
So that leads into the question of the International Court of Justice in The Hague decided yesterday to hear further arguments by South Africa, who is charging genocide against Israel, and it ordered Israel to prevent genocidal acts in Gaza, but it stopped short, the court stopped short of demanding a ceasefire or ruling on longer standing issues such as the annexation, settler violence, the blockade of Gaza, or the general occupation. I know that it's very early in the process, but I wonder if you could share any thoughts that you or some of your community members have had on the ICJ rulings and process, and if you have hope in it.
First of all, I want to appreciate South Africa and the encouragement that they just stand up and speak for our rights and stop the genocide that's being committed against us. I mean, about the International Court of Justice, you know, what it issued, most of the people here, after what it says yesterday, it's like they feel a little bit bad from this, because at least they didn't say to cease fire, you know, to stop the killing of the people and stop the bombing, at least, you know, because, you know, to speak for their language, like for what they are thinking now, if it's a genocide, you are waiting more time to spend to let the more people to being killed also, or what? I don't know why, you know, it's just something like I cannot express it, you know, even in some words. But I mean, most of the people here that, you know, because, you know, we have never witnessed a real international intervene on the ground, you know, most of the people here don't trust to have an justice injunction for the Palestinian rights and to end this apartheid regime. I mean,
yeah, as you say, it's a bit long of a wait for this and kind of lacking some punch. I heard some people talk about it on Democracy Now! This morning, saying that this, you know, maybe they could not make those arguments in a legal situation in the first place, but that they haven't excluded them from the genocide charge. But it is a bit disturbing that they're not calling for an immediate ceasefire to save lives.
Yeah, I mean, this is take your mind out of your head, you know.
Netanyahu's government has made a show of exchanging Palestinian prisoners for hostages from the October 7th attacks or for captured IDF or occupation soldiers. Meanwhile, Israel has been sweeping up hundreds of Palestinians under military occupation law without hearing, the sort of administrative...
Detention.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about how prisons function within the occupation and what you know at the moment about Palestinian prisoners. I know that Al Adamir just put out a report on the situation of Palestinian prisoners that I haven't had a chance to read. But yeah, if you could talk about how prisons are used during the occupation and how they've been used in this process recently.
Yeah, I mean, to speak about the prisons after the 7th of October, it became more and more worse than before. The prisoners have been, you know, humiliated by the Israeli occupation army and soldiers. We have witnessed this during, you know, the time when the Palestinian prisoners, while the exchanging between the Palestinian prisoners and the hostages, and when they got out, we have heard their speeches, how they were treated in the Israeli prisons. They were even the food, even they were denying them from the food, just one meal for 10 people at least, and putting the people in the cold without anything, and, you know, banning them from going outside under the... And if there's a sun, they just banned them from going out of the jail for 15 minutes to smell the air. I don't know what you say it in English, but, you know, I mean, it became worse. And even one of the old people here in Masafrieta was arrested for just he was grazing his sheep in his land. And because one of the settlers said that he attacked him. He was in prison for 4 days. And when we go to pick him back from the prison, from Ramallah in the military prison, we just told the boss about the bad experience that he witnessed in the jail. They were really treated as an animal. They were really humiliated. And he was an old man. They didn't give him any medicine for his health condition. And he was really suffering. He got out of there. And even they didn't give him his phone, his ID until now. They didn't give him anything when he just got released. So... they were really treated bad, and I mean, just you can go and look for the Palestinian prisoners who went out of the jail and see how they were treated in the Israeli jail. It's really, they really were like suffering in the jail. And until now, there's other Palestinians who was like treated. The women, as we have heard from them when they were like released, they were going to be raped, you know, from the Israeli soldiers. And, you know, this like was something really, we cannot like keep silent of that. Because there is like also other women who stayed in the jail and other young Palestinians who was like children and now under the age of 18, they have been even treated bad. So the prisons now is really in a tragic situation there, what's happening there.
Yeah, thank you for speaking on that. I'd be interested to hear if you have an opinion concerning the U.S. Biden administration's decision to impose visa restrictions on individuals coming to and from the U.S. who are believed to have been involved in settler violence in the West Bank. I wonder what this means for people who have U.S. citizenship who are participating in the violence. Also, this obviously comes while the U.S. continues to increase weapon shipments to Israel, where Israeli Minister of National Security Itamar Ben-Gvir has already distributed assault rifles to settlers. And this says nothing about the armaments that the U.S. government actually gives to the army that they're using to assault Gaza with.
I mean, I would just also like to back this question to ask it to you again, that if these restrictions have any effects on the Israeli settler attacks in the West Bank, that have been even, it becomes more low or more higher, or it have been increased. So this is like a question if it was effective on the ground. And the answer is no, because when you ask this question, like, why didn't even stop the military aid to the Israeli government because the Israeli government, even now, they armed the settlers to commit the war crimes against the Palestinians. So like this restrictions, I mean, maybe I just, for my analysis, is just to say for the world that at least the U.S. is doing something to calm down the situation. But in fact, it's not, you know.
Yeah, and it makes sense for the U.S. for the Biden administration to try to say, look, we're being reasonable here because he's facing an election this year. He's already alienated huge parts of the U.S. population by refusing to call out the violence, let alone like pre-October 7th, but since then.
Yeah, and we cannot forget the U.S. government that's been supporting the Israeli occupation since a long time, you know. So this, like, for us, the Palestinian would not change anything for us, you know.
Are there any forms of resistance or organizations in particular from inside of the borders of 48 or elsewhere that you want listeners to make note of? I know that obviously the war is still continuing, the settler violence is still continuing, but I wonder if attempts at blockading arms shipments or protesters going into and blocking government activities, or if there's any of these things that for you, you've seen people do abroad and you say, yes, like more of this, this seems like it could be effective.
I want to speak about all of the Palestinian people who's in the 48 occupied land was still there, and who's even being under the Israeli civilian law, who have been even, because they are like, I mean, now they are a Palestinian who like remain resilient since the 48, and who have now the Israeli citizenship. So they are like, the occupation work hard, I mean, to clearly forgetting them, their indigenous identity. So, and even to do borders between us, even who are the same people, who are Palestinians. So this movement who's got to come out from there is to call for their identity, to stop the, you know, I don't know how I can say it in English, but is to clear, you know, there, in fact, that there are Palestinians who's living under the Israeli law, and they have Israeli citizenship. So, like, we have done with them many activities in order to keep the relationship between the same people who have been under the aggression since the Nakba. So there is, like, even the resistance was still there, but they have no power to face the Israeli government because they are completely under their mercy. And they are really suffering when you want to go to see how, like, they are treated inside. Like, sometimes you can see the apartheid and the racist policy that they use against them. They put on them sanctions. If you want to build a house, you want to pay millions of shekels to build a house. And even it's your land, but they put in your limits to not build.
So even it's inside the occupied 48 land.
And yeah, I mean, even just living, as you say, is a hard enough thing for a Palestinian inside of 48. I'm wondering about activism to attempt to pressure either the Israeli government to stop the war or the U.S. government to stop sending weapons or the U.K. or Germany. I know it's a different thing right now inside of the borders of 48, even for Jewish Israelis, like the response is pretty quick to try to shut down protests. But I wonder if there are any, besides the South African court, any sort of international solidarity that you've seen that seems effective or you want to see more of.
During my life, I have experienced and like meet many like international activists who came and being solidarity with us. I mean, even when they go back to their homes, they don't stop and they just continue to share our stories and what we have been facing, and even share to their friends to come and to visit here and to be with the people at least for 3 months. So I mean, there is like also outside people who is even calling for our rights and calling for our demands and to end the occupation. I mean, and even it's effective because, you know, at least because the Israeli propaganda is hiding the reality. So this, the old generation have been all covered and washed mind by the Israeli propaganda. So now at least we are working on the new generation who is like burning every day to just to tell them about the truth, what's happening here. At some point in the future, they will be at least effective in their governments, in their country, to do solution for the Palestinians.
And you've already named a few groups, too, that are working within the occupied territories and sending people to be in solidarity and listed those as being effective, such as Operation Dove from Italy and the International Solidarity Movement and such. So that's
in the West Bank, there's many organizations who used to be in the West Bank. Like, I mean, there are a lot, really a lot. I can't count them, but there is, yeah. I mean, yeah, I just talked about in Musafir Yatta just around 4 organizations, and there is also more who have been working here. And there is like even other organizations who have been working in other places in the West Bank. Because also there is like the Jordan Valley, the people who's there, they are facing also the same policies of evacuating the people from there, you know.
Well, Mohammed, thank you so much again for having this conversation, and I wish you well. And I will definitely point people to.
No, thank you, Brass, for this like chance to speak and to share our stories for the people who is like unaware of what we are facing. I mean, this like we appreciate this a lot, and right. Hope you can continue this to, you know, to raise awareness about the reality and to end the war crimes and the occupation.
Thank you. It's an honor for me.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
If you want to support The Final Straw Radio, you can subscribe to our podcast via various platforms, follow, rate, and share our materials online, and learn more at tfsr.wtf. And if you'd like to fund our transcription work that allows for easier translation, more accessibility of content, and the zines that we produce from each interview, consider picking up some merch from us or making a one-time or recurring donation via PayPal, Venmo, Stripe, or LibrePay, or joining our Patreon to access early release content and other goodies via the links that you can find at tfsr.wtf/support. And now some words from anarchist prisoner Sean Swain.
Seven people in the U.S. were killed in mass shootings in the month of March 2023. That same month, 99 people were killed by cops, according to an incomplete list compiled by the Washington Post. These are their names: Daniel Ramon Scott, Tony Allen Smith, Stormy Fuller, Chase Lind Allen, name withheld, March 1st, Pueblo, Colorado, James Richard Pavlista, Dylan Martin, Brett Cameron Carter, Aaron Martinka, Donovan Adrian Watson, Najee Seabrooks, Brian Anthony Finch, Patricia Lynn Finch, Philip Christopher Panado, Roberto Corchado, Elias Hans Anderson, Jason Michael Mattingly Jr., Joseph Sherrill, Oquan Ramir Sims, name withheld, March 4th, Williston Highlands, Florida, James Saucedo, Antonio Ibanez, Dexter Wade, Anthony Castro, Andrew Craig Edelman, Roy Street, Daniel Clark, Alexander Parks Holland, Adrian Castillo, Cordell Jones, Manuel Sanabria, George Alejandro, Robert William Atkins, Kassam Radwan Baba, Alejandro Sacedo, Kanoa Kahaley Bishop, Mitchell Negron Jr., Charles Hubbard, Adam Barcenas, Kyle Solstek, Zion William Bostic, Glenard Herndon, Danny Ray Jackson, Nicholas Mauro Sosa, Noe Mejia, Frank Jerry Millsaps, Robert Bluse Clendenning, Michael Obregon, Edridge Alexis, Coy Brent Jackson, Guillermo Padron Huerta, Christopher Michael Martinez, Dalaneo.
Hola amigos, bienvenidos a nuestra emisión quincenal, escuchando América Latina, aquí en CKUT 90.3 FM.
Les informaremos a ustedes sobre el arte, la cultura, poesía y turismo.
También tenemos deportes, información actual y mucho más.
América Latina, ¿eres tú?
América Latina es ella.
América Latina es él.
América Latina somos nosotros.
Argentina,
Bolivia,
Brasil,
Chile,
Costa Rica,
Colombia,
Cuba,
Ecuador,
El Salvador,
Guatemala.
Honduras,
México,
Nicaragua,
Panamá,
Paraguay,
Perú,
República Dominicana,
Uruguay,
Venezuela.
Salir el sol y despedirlo. Quiero caminar y correr a tu lado.